What happens when two Bass Road Warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist, revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. What happens? You're about to find out. It's another episode of Notes from an Artist.
Well, greetings to our listener, and welcome back to another chilling, intellectually filling, thrilling, shilling episode of Notes from an Artist. I'm Tom Semioli on one mic, and who are you on that other mic?
I'm David C. Gross.
My co-host, David C. Gross. You know, David, in the past 3 years, we have been blessed to converse and become friends with our musical heroes, namely Ron Carter, greatest living jazz bassist, I think, Gary Carr, greatest living classical bassist, Steve Hackett of Genesis, and Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones. But I am so excited on our show this evening is sports television journalist and producer Todd Ehrlich. If you have watched sports in the last 30 years, 30 plus years on New York television or national television, you have seen and heard the work and artistry of Todd Ehrlich, because this is Notes from an Artist and Todd is an artist. He has been recognized by his peers with multiple Emmy Awards and citation. Todd's new book, Todd's only book, is entitled The 20 Greatest Moments in New York Sports History, Our Generation of Memories from 1960 to Today. He wrote it with Gary Myers. It is out now. It is on the best seller lists. It is put out by Sports Publishing, which is an imprint of Skyhorse Publishing, and you can get that in hard copy or digitally, as Todd will remind you throughout the
over
interview.
And over and over again. God bless him.
God bless him. You know, in an age, sadly, when journalism has given way to corporate jingoism and hyperbole and sensationalism and opinion-driven misinformation, Todd is an honest voice, and it's refreshing to hear and read that. Athletes trust him, and when you hear Todd on the show tonight, you'll see why they do. It's kind of like the trust we have with our musical colleagues. So Todd is very simpatico with what we do on Notes from an Artist. David, as we say, this is, and throughout the interview, this is more than a sports book. This is a book about the culture. It's about relationships. It is about the fragility of a career in sports. One moment can define an entire lifetime, an entire career. It's about family. Todd wrote this for his son. Todd said in the interview he didn't want to get involved in politics, but politics does come to the surface when we talk Ollie Frazier and Joe Namath. And if you're a Yankee fan, David, you're going to love this book.
I certainly do. As a matter of fact, 9 of the 20 stories in this book, or actually 21 because there's a bonus chapter, are all about Yankees and various games over various years. And I must say, one of the things that thrilled me about the book was the fact that at the very beginning of each chapter, he talks about who was the mayor, what the price of gas was, what was the top movie, what was the top artist. And it really brings you back. And the great thing about it is, if you don't remember those dates, you can go on Google, go to Wikipedia, go somewhere, and you will find all the answers. Todd has given you a free thumbnail of what it was like at that particular time.
Absolutely. And getting back to the baseball, it's the stuff you don't get on the YES Network or MLB.com. So Yankee fans, including my dear friend and musical colleague, Katina Bryant, you're going to learn about Jim Leyritz and what might have been the most important home run in Yankee history. Behind the scenes with Aaron Judge, it gives me a whole new outlook on Aaron and his career. I love how Todd reflects on Mike Piazza's 9/11 home run. You remember that September 21st, the Mets versus the Braves, the first game after 9/11. And probably the single most important home run in baseball.
It very well be. You'll hear more about that in our show.
Yeah, but it just, you know, it brought New Yorkers back together. It's a book that you can go back to time and time again, which is what I love about it, whether it's for reference or the sheer joy of reading. Notes from an Artist, we like to present the best, even though you and I are the host of the show.
we take what we can get, right?
But as far as New York sports books goes, this is the best one I've ever read. So bravo, kudos to Tom.
How many have you read?
I've read lots of them. I read a lot of Stan Fischler books, Verducci books and things, but Todd really gets to the crux of things. And again, it's because the athletes trust him, and he met me,
you were his best friend, right?
Yes, and now I'm no longer
that's because I was given the honor.
You're officially Todd Ehrlich's bestie. how the mighty have fallen. So, and yes, we love the fact that Todd takes the piss out of us, as we do so deserve. No one else does that. Where Absolutely. Do we have a guest that insults the host? This is we yearn for this.
He insults us. He promotes his book, A True New Yorker.
Yes, and everything he says is true. That's the sad part, or that's the fun part. So, without further fondue, David, let us bring on Todd Ehrlich.
There he is, ladies and gentlemen. Todd Ehrlich has made it to, congratulations, Todd. You have mastered one of the prime technologies of the 21st century. That is Zoom. And how does a media maven like you, Todd, a media magnate have trouble with Zoom? Or is it just your, do you not use Zoom at T-Line TV very much?
I work at Channel 11, and I used to, prior to taking this job, I used Zoom to edit at CBS Sports and WCBS by a computer, but I haven't had to use it since.
David and I live on Zoom.
No, I'm well aware. I used to live on Zoom too, but okay. So no, I've not used it from this computer since I moved into this house.
And Todd is living in New Jersey, David. David is in Connecticut.
Hi, David in Connecticut.
And I'm Hello, on the other side. Okay. Well, David, let's start our show for our audience member. Our guest is Todd Ehrlich. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Todd Ehrlich, because not everybody knows who he is. Hard to believe. If I get your introduction wrong, please correct me or embellish it at will. Todd Ehrlich has been in the television business now 35 years, I'm going to say.
I started in 84, so 40.
40 years. Wow. Good God.
Yeah, I'm old.
He's old. And he's been a producer, a writer. He has been on air talent. Todd has 20 Emmy nominations. How many wins have you gotten out of 20?
22.
Okay.
And 5 wins.
5 wins, David.
Yeah.
5 Emmy nominations.
Really amazing.
Todd is also.
Thank you, David. You're now my favorite of the two hosts. Can we make that clear?
Yeah.
You nudged out Tom, who I've loved for decades.
But yeah, let me tell you.
In one utterance, you leapfrogged him. Well done.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Well, that's usually the case here.
Yes.
You
know?
I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that I, too, share those feelings.
I appreciate that.
I'm the hated beetle. Anyway, getting back to Todd Ehrlich, David, because he is our guest, for God's sakes.
Yes, please. Thomas.
Oh, yeah. He is on the New York Emmy Board of Governors. And he will put in a good word for us, I'm sure. He's produced and been involved with many award-winning TV specials, namely Komen, Race for the Cure, right, for cancer.
100% true. Raised money and awareness for breast cancer.
He's also done Tunnel to Towers for the 9/11 first responders.
Money and awareness for Tunnel to Towers, who helps some severely injured veterans and does a lot of good around the country.
You also produce some Super Bowl programs. You have 8 New York State Broadcast Association Awards. Is that correct?
100% accurate, my dear friend. You nailed that one, Tom.
I got it. See, I can read. And he's also president and CEO, head muckety muck of T-Line Productions. And that
or
is
T-Line TV.
T-Line TV. Okay. And that is, as the name implies, a TV production company. He currently resides in New Jersey. His son, his son is named Jagger after Michael Philip Jagger. Good choice of names. I don't think Moon Unit or Dweezil Ehrlich or Zoe Ehrlich would have worked. I like
Jagger. We thought about it.
You
we,
thought about
we
that.
About all those. We but tried
Ozzy
them all.
Ehrlich might have been the good, though. Yeah. Ozzy Ehrlich? Yeah,
Ozzy that would have worked. Good. Nah, I like Jagger. And, of course, his wife, Debbie, keeps Todd in line. That is her.
Oh, is true or worse?
Now, does it keep, wait a second. Does he keep him in line or T-line? That's the real key here.
And on a personal note for Todd, Todd is a Deadhead, David. He's a fan of the Grateful Dead, plays guitar. What is your favorite era of the Dead, Todd? Is it the Pigpen era, the Godchow years, or the Brett Midland years?
Brett Midland.
You like that?
That's when I was. So I was introduced to the Dead on a teen tour by Brian Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
He brought me up to his room. Nobody could interrupt us. He played me Morning Dew from the Lyceum in London from 1972. Mm-hmm. I was hooked since then. That was 1980. Mm. So I was weaned on the Brett Midland days, and I loved him.
Wow. And note, David, that he's the only of our guests that have said the word weaned, on our show.
That's right. We never even interviewed anyone from Ween.
Is that true? No one's called Tom a weenie?
No one's called me, not on air, yeah. Anyway. But more importantly, David, we're here to talk to Todd about his best-selling book, 20 Great...
War and Peace, right?
20 Greatest Moments in New York Sports History from 1960 to today. That's my lifespan. Our Generation of Memories, and it's written with Gary Myers, correct?
100% accurate. Tom, to be serious for 1 second, then we'll go back to the nonsense.
Yes.
I greatly appreciate an opportunity to talk about this labor of love. It was an overnight sensation, like most success stories are. Came up with the concept in 2003. It only took 2 decades. You know, I'm a slow learner. And then took 2 solid years of nights and weekends to write. Very, very proud of it. And I'm very excited to have an opportunity to talk to you and great David C. Gross. We don't know what the C stands for, but
it's a dirty word.
It's a very dirty word.
It's a very dirty. Well, there's so many books within this book. And I have to say, with the exception of the Aaron Judge home run in 2022, which we will talk about a little bit later, all the moments occur, or most of these moments occur, before social media dominated the landscape. Now, if we look at the timeline, Facebook started, 2004? You had YouTube in 2005. You had Twitter in 2006. Instagram, 2010. TikTok, David, your favorite, in 2016. But those platforms took a while to materialize. This is a time, your 20 moments, is when network and cable TV news kind of defined what was great in sports. We had the back pages of the Daily News and the Post, the New York Times. They set the agenda, not only for sports, but how we perceive the world around us. What do you comment on that? Comment how media shapes our view of sports.
Okay. So that got nothing to do with the book, but I love you.
Well,
so
it's something that comes from the book.
I will comment on anything you want me to comment on.
Okay.
So I believe that social media has taken away the ability for mass media to, like you said, shape the way in which we see the world. And it has given that power to the individuals. So now, for example, Deion Sanders goes to Colorado. He appears on 60 Minutes, but well before he appeared on 60 Minutes, he crafted his own image, told his own story through his own social media. So as I came up in the TV landscape, I would go into locker rooms and people would confide in me because A, I was an honest broker of what they were telling me, but also because I was the conduit to the fans. And now they have the ability to be their own mouthpiece to the fans. So it has changed. It has changed quite a bit. And I don't know for the better, because the one thing that the media did and prided itself on prior to social media was being fair and balanced. Now, that term was hijacked by a network that is out there in the TV landscape. Being a journalist, being a part of the media, we prided ourselves on telling both sides of the story and being fair and balanced in the way in which we report the news. Now, by definition, if you have your own social media channel, you're going to be biased towards yourself. So a lot of the stuff that gets out there to the public is not necessarily telling both sides of the story.
While we're on this subject, having read your book, and I really enjoyed it, it meant a lot to me because I grew up pretty much through all of it. I'm a real big baseball fan, always been my favorite sport. 9 of the 20 great moments, almost half, are baseball stories.
Hey, here we go. We got a real pressure cooker going here. Holy cow, I think he's going to make it.
Before we get into the details of each of those nine things, Tom and I have been talking about this a lot lately, and it has to do with MLB.com, with ESPN, now Amazon. Everyone who cares about an all-star game, because you can see your favorite players anytime you want, whatever team they're on. The statistics have become overbearing. It's no longer a baseball game anymore. Care to comment?
Well, ask me a specific question. First of all, can I just comment? Wait, hold on. Before you do that, can I just say again, you are my favorite of the two co-hosts because you said you read and liked the book. So, Tom, I don't know how you're going to come back from this. And I know you probably 30 years, but this guy, David, love that guy.
Todd, do you know?
You don't know as well as I do.
I had to narrate the book into a cassette player and send him the copy, you know, because he didn't even know how to work an audio book. And he had to deal with my voice for about 40 hours. It was awful.
You know, the reflections we're, what David mentioned, before you get to answer his question, is that's the way, when I felt, when I read this book, that's what it immediately drew me back. Now, David and I are a little bit older, but we're like, going, wow, each chapter is a time capsule in this book. And it's fascinating to glimpse into the past and see who the mayor was. Like we saw a lot of John Lindsay's and a lot of Rudy Giuliani's in each one. But you're absolutely right. And I don't want to sound like grumpy old men, because we are. And like David says, is that the game has evolved. Now, my guess with baseball is that it had to evolve because we're no longer a contemplative society. You can't wait anymore for the back page of the Daily News. You can't wait for the back page of the Post anymore. And that really kind of comes out in this book. There's some, like I said, there's more than just the actual play and what happened in the book.
So the way in which I crafted the book is I wanted to make it visceral. So what I did was I started with, as you alluded to, a time capsule. I wanted to take the reader back. So like you said, who was mayor? Who was president? What was the price of gas?
Yeah.
Who won the Oscar? Who won the Grammy? So it's like, wow, that was my favorite song. I don't know if you guys like music or not, but music, well, I would assume, I don't know, whatever. But the thing with music is when you hear a song, it takes you back. Where were you? When did you first hear that song? Who were you dating? Who were your friends? And so I wanted to start with a time capsule. And then, like you said, I wanted it to be more than just the moment. So I did the pregame after that. And that's the story of, how do we get to the moment itself? What were the big trades? What were the big draft picks? What were the huge games? Then I go into Peter Boddy, who's a wonderful, huge, a very popular, very respected writer in New York City, wrote an article on the moment. And then my favorite part is the post game. Yes. I interviewed over 100 people to get, first of all, their reaction to those moments. What did it mean to them? What are the stories? And then they took us back. And my favorite line that I got when conducting these interviews was, hey, Todd, I'm going to share a story with you that I haven't shared before. And there's a lot of them in this book. Mm. And I also got people to share funny stories.
Yes.
Of the hijinks that they played on each other. And the thing that was important to me is I got some people to share some stuff that was controversial that would have made news with this. And I didn't use those stories because I wasn't looking to make news. What I was looking to do is accurately depict history and put smiles on people's faces. And I have a six-year-old, Tom, as you know very well, as the man that I liked a lot more than David, up until almost a half hour ago, to be honest with you. And then David surpassed you very quickly and easily. You know Jagger. And for me, he's growing up in New York. Right. And for me, I wanted him to know the history of New York. Mm. And I thought if I could lay it out clearly for him, that when he sits around and has conversations with his friends, he can point to fact. Also, I wanted to have the ability to have dinner table conversation with my son. And I wanted people in our area and around our country to talk to their sons and their fathers and have three generations of people talking about these unbelievable moments that, yes, are New York's greatest moments, but a lot of them are national moments as well. So I thought that was important as well.
Absolutely. Well, you know, what comes out in this book also is just you get to see the human side of the player. And we don't always get to see that. One of the things that's happened in modern television now, as soon as somebody hits a home run, there's a microphone in his face. How do you feel? You just hit up. Well, And we get to see really how fragile their careers are. You know, we take it for granted. I mean, all these incidents, all these 20 plays you described, there's luck, opportunity, and fate all come together. And it's amazing when you read through each of the moments, how one moment can define a career. Now, he was a guy that was an average player.
Well, he was an above average fielder, but he was an average to below average hitter.
Yes, exactly.
And he not only had the home run against the Red Sox at Fenway Park, but went on to win the MVP of the World Series. And he wasn't hitting well going into playoff game and Fenway Park. And then all of a sudden in baseball, as David well knows, you get hot, you stay hot.
Yeah.
And he rode that through the playoffs until a World Series championship. And quite frankly, it defined his career. And it could not have happened to a nicer man.
Yeah.
What a gentleman. So generous with his time. And quite frankly, I'll share with you that I went to Old Timers Day to get a lot of these interviews. And Bucky walked me around and said, hey, Chris, to Chris Chambliss and to other people, Bernie and other people, hey, this is Todd Ehrlich. He's a mensch. He's a great guy. No, I'm serious. He might not have used mensch, but he might have. We don't know. I can neither confirm nor deny allegations. But he introduced me and said, guys, talk to him. He's a trusted journalist. And that probably helped people open up. Idri telling me the story of hiding from George Steinbrenner, stuff like that, that I might not have gotten without an introduction like that from somebody as respected as Bucky Dent. And this whole project is just a series of people helping me, of Ken Davidoff, Steve Serby, Tim Rapley, saying, let me edit and fact check your book for you. Who does that? Who has the time to do stuff like that, much less the inclination, much less volunteer to do that? And I hope, I believe, and Tom, you know me pretty well. David, you don't know me at all, so you can't vote on this. But I try to treat everybody with respect. I mean, I try to value everybody. My hope is that this book is sort of a culmination of that, that all of these athletes I've had on my shows all these years and treated fairly, ask the hard questions, always ask the tough questions, but was always fair with everybody. They gave me their time. They gave me their stories. Journalists spoke to me and again, helped me fact check the book, helped me edit the book. Gary Myers came on at the last second to help me write five of the pre-games when my other partner dropped out. I was a little busy raising a six-year-old, running a sports department at Channel 11 and moving into a new house. And I needed a little bit of help. And he's like, I'm 100% there for you, Todd. And so an overnight sensation, 20 years to get the thing sold. It took a village. It certainly wasn't just me.
Yeah, but
so many people helped me.
It does exemplify, again, you talk about before the trust with the journalist and the athlete. And David and I find the same thing in our show notes from an artist that, because we're two guys that were in the trenches as bass players, we have a simpatico relationship and they open up and talk to us. And I mean, David and I, not to toot our own hornets, but I'm astounded at the guests that we got, that we've had.
In reading this book, now Tom and I know the lifespan of a professional musician is not unlike the lifespan of a professional athlete.
Right.
Whether it's a 5-peat span or a 20-man roster, there is a close camaraderie that comes about. It's a really wonderful thing. While we're here, I want to go back to one of my favorite parts of the book because I really did live that story and I lived that day, which is the 1969 Mets game against Baltimore. So, Mayor John Lindsay, Best Picture, Oliver. I saw that on Broadway a few years earlier than that. And some of my good buddies, including Patty Duke's brother, who's actually Paul O'Keefe, we were in the same league of prep schools playing baseball and everything together. He was in it.
Meet Cat Matthews live most everywhere, from Zanzibar to Berkeley Square.
But Patty's only seen the sights a girl can see from Brooklyn Heights. What a crazy pair! But they're cousins, identical cousins all the way. One pair of matching bouquets, different as night and day.
Where Kathy adores a minuet, the ballet Russe, and Crepe Suzette.
Our Patty loves to rock and roll, a hot dog makes her lose control. What a wild duet, still they're cousins, identical cousins, and you find.
They laugh alike,
they walk alike, at times they even talk alike. You can lose your mind when cousins are two of a kind.
The best actor was Cliff Robertson for Charlie. That would never happen again. For many reasons. Streisand, Kate Hepburn, Glenn Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, a Jimmy Webb tune. Mrs. Robinson brings in Simon and Garfunkel, brings in The Graduate. President was Nixon, 34 cents a gallon. Unbelievable. I'm leaving prep school. I'm leaving Aeron Prep, which was on 70th between Lexington and 3rd. I've got my transistor radio. I'm headed to work. I was working at this clothing boutique because I could get all these clothes cheap and look good on stage in my little high school bands. I'm listening. And boom, Mets win. And I remember it was a beautiful day. I was just in my school blazer. It was a beautiful day. You told a great story about it. So now that Tom is lower in your esteem even more so, why don't we get into this?
Yeah, no, I would love it. And quite frankly, it really means a lot. As you sit in and you come up with concept for something, be it a TV show or a book, and then you get the feedback, the desired feedback that you were going for to bring somebody like you back to that moment in time. And the fact that my idea actually came to fruition and worked, really, it's meaningful. It means a lot. I appreciate you sharing that.
Let's stay on the year 1969, because two chapters that blew me away, and I'm old enough to remember, were Super Bowl III. And of course, Ollie Frazier. And these were more than sporting events. This was the counterculture versus the establishment. This was Joe Namath and a rock star. He was the first rock star athlete with his long hair. And then, of course, Ollie, who refused to serve in Vietnam. I mean, families were divided over the Ollie Frazier fight. I mean, it was like, again, counterculture versus the establishment. How was it for you researching that time? Do you actually remember the Ollie Frazier fight, Todd?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I saw the Ollie Frazier fight at the Capitol Center with my big brother. I don't know if you guys know about the Big Brother Association, but kids, at least in my era when I grew up, I don't know if it still exists. If your parents were divorced, there were male authority figures that were part of the Big Brothers Association that would step in and sort of serve as a father figure. And Alan Lewis was that man for me. And he took me to the Capitol Center to see that fight. And I remember it vividly. I didn't understand at the time about counterculture. I didn't understand at the time how much Ollie gave up in order to stand up to the establishment and not go into the draft, as he said that no Viet Cong ever did anything to me, so he's not going to go over and kill them, and how he risked going to jail, he was stripped of his titles. And it was one of the first time that a former undefeated champion, maybe the only time ever by definition, and an undefeated heavyweight champion did battle. Then what was also interesting about that, by the way in which you set it up, is Joe Frazier was embraced by the establishment, if you will, right?
Right, yes.
And so what's so interesting about that is Ollie painted him, and he regretted it, and they had a big divide over it. And then when I came back together as an Uncle Tom, which was exactly the opposite as they were painted by society. He was a great promoter, and he knew how to get headlines when, as you said, newspapers were invaluable to selling this around the world. And it was billed as the fight of the century. And some of the people that I interviewed said, not only was it billed as the fight of the century, but it was better than advertised. The Ali and Frazier said, Ali once said that it was as close as he had ever felt to death itself. And the two of them went nose to nose, and they fought two more times. Frazier won this battle in MSG, and then Ali won the second two. And what also was interesting about this was it was another spot where sports transcended athletics, yeah. Where Frank Sinatra couldn't get a ticket. They volunteered to be a photographer. No, this is true. Right. He volunteered to be a photographer for Life magazine. Woody Allen, I mean, every major star of the day was ringside. There was one of the things that, one of the stories that I really like is Joe Frazier wasn't known for carrying cash with him. They were walking around the garment industry and he was with a promoter and somebody that backed his syndicate, and they saw a homeless man, and it turned out to be a former champion, and so Joe asked him, hey man, can you give me $100, whatever, and said, hey champ, here's $100. And everybody that I interviewed said Joe would give you the shirt off of his back. He was just that kind of guy. And later in life he and Ali mended fences, but yeah. There was a lot of hurt feeling from the hype surrounding that fight.
Yeah, really was. And of course, we can't discount the role that Howard Cosell played. Such an eloquent, outrageous, intellectual, painting pictures with his words. And he's such an important part of that. And an important part of a lot of these 20 great moments. Let's stay in the year 1969. Is there a...
The other thing about the book, it's not just the memory of 1969. For instance, we're talking about newspapers. I was old enough in second grade to remember the Daily News photograph the day of the Liston Cassius Clay fight. All that was on the cover of the Daily News was Liston's fist, which is about twice the size of both of mine. It was just enormous. And even, what, how old are you in second grade? Thomas, how old am I in second grade?
I was about 8 years old, 9 years old.
So I was a year ahead because of birthdays. So I was seven.
Okay.
And that had an enormous effect on me. But once again, if we weren't going backwards and looking at things through this book, da 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 da. So there are little tributaries that you have struck. And if Tom was in the room, I'd probably strike him
too.
You
would strike me. But what I was saying was, getting back to the 1969, you document the Knicks. And was there a team that had more charisma than the 69 New York Knicks? And again, it takes you back to a time when you knew, even if you weren't a sports fan, you knew who Tom Terrific was. You knew who Broadway Joe was. You knew Mr. October. You knew Louisiana Lightning. You knew Mookie. You knew Yogi and Doc and all those people. And that's another, I'm glad that made the 20 moments. And it's amazing now that the Knicks, I'm sure you've met Walt Frazier many times. There's always a crowd of people around him 50 years later.
One of the things I found interesting about him is Clyde told me, said, I know where somebody knows me from by what they call me. They call me Clyde, they know me as a Nick. They call me Walt, they're from down south, Atlanta, and they know me from where I grew up. I also found it really interesting that both he and Marv told me that he's a shy person. Who would have thought that?
Clyde is a guy who dresses in a banana yellow suit. I mean,
but he said that there's a huge delineation between Walt, who likes to stay home, likes to be quiet, likes to be with family, and then Clyde, who likes to go out, enjoy a couple cocktails. Back in the day, he enjoyed the ladies.
Yeah.
He enjoyed the limelight. He said, but nights that he wasn't out, he really liked to be home. And I found that super interesting as well. And then obviously, he's named after Bonnie and Clyde because he wore the hat just like Clyde in the movie. And I thought that was pretty cool. So yeah, a lot of really good things. And talked about sort of the construction of that team.
Mm.
And that's when teams were really built and how each one fit together and to become a champion and what the captain meant. And then obviously the poignant moment is when Willis Reed walks out before game seven. And Marv told me that it's the loudest he had ever heard the Madison Square Garden in his life. Marv told me that when the captain came out and emerge, that Jerry West and Will Chamberlain stopped what they were doing and just stared. And that's when Clyde said, you know what? We got him. We're going to win this game. And so Willis Reed, he's credited with obviously being the captain, inspiring his team. Nevertheless, he scored 4 points. He had two buckets.
Yeah.
So it's Clyde that had the huge statistical night. that night to give the Knicks their first championship.
Amazing, amazing stuff. And of course, you talk about other teams. You document the 94 Rangers. And then I didn't realize until I read the book that, my gosh, the 94 Rangers are really the Edmonton Oilers. I mean, you had Mark Messier, Adam Graves, Kevin Lowe, Glenn Anderson, Issa Tinkinen. You know that name, David.
That's so.
Jeff Bookaboom, great name for a bass player. And Craig McTavish. So it's I never felt that they were a New York team. Am I right or wrong about that?
No, you're 100% wrong. What's wrong with you? It said New York on their jersey.
Oh, okay. So that's what makes it.
We won the first Stanley Cup since 1940 in this city. Come on, Tom.
The last real.
You're killing Craig Stanton. Craig Stanton I know. Just passed out.
I know. We have to revive him.
Yes.
No, but the real last Rangers was Duguay, Esposito,
Sanderson,
all the guys in the jeans commercial. That was the Rangers.
Yeah, but they didn't win. They didn't win.
I know. But
Messier brought you a Stanley Cup. Just say thank you.
Say it, David.
Thank you. But at the same time, even with the Mets winning in 69, being a Yankee fan, it was like, oh, yeah. But around the country, because that's the only game you could watch on TV, you were either rooting for the Mets.
You did. David, show off your tchotchke to Todd.
Oh,
you got to see this. David's been talking about this for weeks.
Yeah, I brought it up from outside. That's, you know what it is?
Yeah, it's a seat from Yankee Stadium.
Oh,
great.
He's very proud. Very good.
Now, I got that when the stadium closed. Paid $349. It's probably worth around 19 cents now because they sold every one of them. And
but
now
what's it worth to you, David?
What's it? Yes.
David. Well, that's where I was getting
priceless.
To. Todd, let me get
that. Friendship with Tom. Priceless.
So basically, until I moved to Connecticut, I used to think Connecticut was like a Yankee town, but it's a New England town. So this is great for my Red Sox fans and friends that come over, and I can just piss them off. It's priceless.
Yes, agreed.
Okay. Now,
you should stick with what you're good at, Dave.
I tell them
people off, that's what you should stick with.
Listen, I had a mentor who said to me, if you haven't annoyed someone by noon, you're not doing your job.
Yes.
Tom, so that's why I call Tom about 8 a.m. every day.
That's why he calls me 8 a.m. Also in this book, you talk about the 2000 World Series between the Yankees and the Mets. Now, I was living in New York City at the time, as I am now. And the Yankees totally dominated this city in the 1990s, as the Mets did in the 1980s. And I felt when the Yankees won the World Series, there were no Mets fans here. It was like being gay in the 50s. You know, you had to wear a handkerchief in your left pocket or your right pocket. If you wore a Met hat, you know, somebody would wink at you. It just felt like the Yankees beat another team. It just didn't seem like it really wasn't a Subway Series like my parents would talk about the Yankees and the Dodgers. Was that me because I was in Manhattan or maybe in Queens and Brooklyn and the Bronx, it was different?
So I think it's two things. I think number one, and maybe this book guilty of it, you look back in reverence to history. So the Subway Series, when everybody was dressing up and it was the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants and the New York Yankees, was really looked back upon with real reverence and as the golden era of baseball in this town. So I think there is some of that. I think that there's a little bit of the Yankees have won so many championships. There's really sort of a little bit of a class system in New York sports where the Giants are the old guard. They've won three. The Jets have won one. The Knicks have won two championships. The Nets haven't won since the ABA. The Yankees and the Mets, which you just eloquently pointed out, the Rangers to the Islanders, even though it's the reverse in terms of championships, there is sort of a blue blood thing. And as somebody that I like very, very much that has given me the opportunity to talk about my book, I don't want to disagree with you. I think it's bad form as a guest. Well, I don't feel good about it, but I'm going to anyway because
please do.
Just texted me. It's okay.
Beat him.
Here's the way it worked, Tom. During the Subway series, there was nothing else anybody in this town talked about besides the Subway series. Houses were divided, front and back page. Not just the back page of every tabloid. It was the lead of the news in the A block as well as the sports. There were sports specials. I was working in the media at the time. And funny because Bernie Williams said to me, he goes, you know, it reminded me of my high school days where you played your crosstown rival, got on a bus and off you went. Clemens said what was crazy to him is he would go into a restaurant and he couldn't buy a meal. Both Yankee fans and Met fans were buying him a meal probably before he threw the bat at Piazza. And afterwards, he probably had to pay for his own meal. But I mean, I don't know. I'm not here to judge what the man told me. I'm just gracious he gave me time to share his stories. And also the reason that I included that in the book as opposed to the 98, which is possibly the greatest Yankee team of all time, or 96. Right. When they were down 2-1 and facing being down 3-1 till Jim Leyritz hit his historic home run with Daryl Strawberry's bat, which I'll tell you the story in a second. Oh. The reason I told the Subway series is, again, with the Islanders, the reason I had the moment being the Edmonton series is you had to pick one moment, and then the pregame I could tell the history.
Yeah.
So the Yankees won 4 out of 5. So I told the whole series about how they got to the Subway series. And then that being the Battle of New York, that being a Subway series, so resonated that that was the moment. And then I'd like to harken back to Jim Leyritz just for 1 second.
Yes, yes.
King was nice enough to do a book signing with me.
Yes.
At Bookends, which is Gary Myers told me, and he knows everything. Just ask him and sit down, get relaxed, and maybe a snack because he can talk for a long time about the subject of how much he knows. He told me it's the number one independent bookstore in the country. So I was sure I didn't get myself in there. Gary got me in there. Gary's a New York Times bestselling author, and I'm a friend of Tom Seminoli, basically, is my claim to fame. We got a book signing at Bookends. Leyritz came and did the signing with me, expecting to sell like 30, 35 books. Walter, who owns the place, came up to me afterwards and says, Todd, you're not going to believe it. I said, yep, probably not. What do you got for me? He goes, we sold out of books. I'm like, oh, how many did we sell? 40? He goes, no, 150 books. There's more people trying to buy them, and we don't have it. So I was thrilled about that. And now Jim Leyritz tells me in the book, the Yankees, 1996, are down 2-1. They're down 3 runs with 1 out in the 8th inning. Jim Leyritz is about to go to bat, facing Mark Wahlers, who throws over 100 miles an hour. He's catching the next day against Smoltz. Smoltz also throws heat. So he looks at his bat rack. He's got 2 bats. He goes, I don't know what to do. He looks in the corner, and Strawberry has a whole box, brand new box, full of Mizuno bats. And he goes, hey, Strawman, can I borrow one of the bats? He goes, yeah, whatever. You know, I mean, they're in the heat of the game. He goes up, and as he walks to the plate, Zim goes, remember, throwing 100 miles an hour. Well, Wahlers decides to throw him a slider at 86. Not a good move. Leyritz turns on it. 3-run home run. Yankees tie the game, win in extras, don't lose again. So that propelled them, obviously, to their first World Series. The story that was told to me is that Steinbrenner, had they lost, was going to trade Mariano Rivera, break up the team, fire Torrey. So Jim Leyritz not only started that run, but saved the dynasty.
Wow.
And he went on to tell me, which I found interesting. He goes, I've never told that story before about Strawberry's bat. I'm like, well, thank you for telling me. It'll be inscribed in the book of life, as some of our people like to say. And he says, you know, it's a lot like Bucky Dent. Bucky Dent against the Red Sox in the playoff game, and Fenway pregame, as we discussed earlier in this podcast, was not hitting the ball well. And so Mickey says, why don't you use one of my bats? So once he fouled the ball off his shin and there was a 10-minute delay, Mickey was sitting there with the bat on his knees, and he told the bat boy, hey, get Bucky over here. He gave him the bat, and he goes, hey, Bucky, there's a home run in this bat. And lo and behold, there was a home run in this bat. The two of the biggest home runs in the history of the most storied franchise in the history of sports were done with other people's equipment.
Wow.
These are the stories you get for under $30. Under $30.
That's actually one or two espresso martinis in New York.
Yeah, know? It's about one or two. Well, on the thread of home runs, tell our listener why the 9/11 home run was so important.
The 9/11 home run was so important. So I was living in New York at the time. There is no way to describe what New Yorkers felt at that time. New Yorkers are resilient. New Yorkers do not let anything get them down. New Yorkers don't let anything stop them from achieving their goals and living their life to the fullest. This was devastating. We lost close to 3,000 of our loved ones. There is not one person I know that wasn't touched by it, that didn't know somebody that perished that day. And more than that, what people won't remember is the feeling that this isn't over. I don't know if I can drive across the GW Bridge. I don't know at any moment that it won't be blown up. I don't know that I can drive through the Lincoln Tunnel. I don't know that a bomb won't go off and it won't flood. I don't know that I can go into Grand Central Station and take a subway. I don't know that somebody won't come in with a machine gun. And the city was paralyzed. Now, I gave blood that night. Everyone yes. gave blood. We supported each other. We didn't know that we had the permission to live our life. We didn't know that we had the permission to cheer. We didn't know that we had the permission to enjoy anything. Time of horror and tragedy. The Mets almost didn't play the game. They, as Jim Ducati, who was assistant GM, details in the book, the team was divided, sharply divided on playing the game. They feared for their own lives. And it wasn't until, first of all, Outlighters, John Franco, got up and spoke to the team and said what it would, they were New Yorkers, and what it would mean to their city to have this team come back and play a game and give New Yorkers a chance to come out and start to feel sort of normal again. And then the police came and said that there will be no place safer in the country based on the security we will have, that they voted to play the game. Then Leiters was down at Ground Zero and traded one of its Met hats for NYPD hat. And, right. and what happened was he then got hats from the NYPD and the FDNY, and the team wore them. The commissioner told them that they are not allowed to do it. It breaks the uniform code and they would be fine. Al said, "You come down and take the hat off our head, okay? Because we're wearing it." He said the emotion of the first responders that ring the field when they came out wearing those hats is something he will never forget. Liza Minnelli formed that night and hugged Jay Payton as she came off the field. And his mother sent her the picture and she signed it for him. It's one of his most treasured items. And Todd Zeal told me that when Mike Piazza went up and hit his home run, watched the tape, he said he didn't even flinch because it was meant to happen. He wasn't surprised. And Omar Minaya said that this moment, that home run gave Jay Payton also, gave New Yorkers a moment to feel normal, a moment to cheer, a moment with deference to the fallen, but a moment to know that we will climb out of this. That's why, in my opinion, it was so important.
And so eloquently told. I think probably the newest of your chapters is Aaron Judge's 60-second home run. Now, I'm a little confused. So Aaron Judge holds the American League record for home runs, but how can we say that when there's interleague play now and the two leagues play each other?
Okay, well, first of all, you just said it eloquently.
Yes.
As you referred to me, you did a great job, Tom.
See that, David?
There are two distinct leagues, and there's two distinct records. Ed Randall said, you know what? The Yankee record is as or more important than the American League record.
Okay.
Also, the fellas in front of him that played in the National League, Bonds, McGuire, and Sosa, all use steroids.
Okay.
So Roger Maris Jr., his son, said that Judge is the legitimate home run champion of baseball. So there's that as well. And I can share to you how it was added to the book, if that's...
Yes, please, please.
I just didn't want to hijack the entire podcast. So I thought I would give you a chance to say, please, please. I love it when you beg.
You like to learn, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even from so, you.
Yeah. So Aaron Judge is bumping along as he's getting, you know, towards August. I start going, oh my. If he sets this record, I'm going to have to write a whole other chapter. I had my 20 chapters. I was done. And this is the hardest thing I've ever done, Tom. Writing this book is the hardest thing I've ever, ever done. Ever on the planet Earth, the one which...
How difficult was this book, Todd?
It was difficult, David. I'm not going to lie to you. It was difficult.
Hey, but Todd, while you're here, there's something I want to talk about.
Right, I didn't really revel in writing another chapter, but when he broke the record, I had a meeting with Gary and my publisher, and I said, we need to add a chapter. So two things happened. Thing number one, we took Connors and Crickstein, and it was pretty much written. I mean, I'm not saying it was 100% done, but it was pretty much written. And we decided long after, but I always wanted to keep it because it was a big memory for me. Mm-hmm. As if you shared memories for you. So it's a bonus chapter. So you, Tom, are going to spend $30 to buy this book, to buy the 20 greatest moments, and you're going to get 21 for the price of 20.
Look at that,
David. A bargain, I tell you.
I'm telling you, bargain at any price.
Right? I mean, you can't believe
this. But Todd, we're giving this stuff away.
Don't be shy.
Sell books, Todd. Sell books.
So look, though.
Barnes & Noble. Where books are sold. So here's what happened. So Aaron Judge breaks the record. I've been covering him all year.
Yes.
And I had a really good relationship with him. But as you guys well know, he was free agent. He had a thing with Cashman. Cashman disclosed some of the negotiations, which didn't sit well with Aaron. And he turned down the money and said he wasn't negotiating during the year. So as the season was coming to an end, he heard as if he was probably going to play elsewhere and almost did. So I'm now in the clubhouse. After the final game, the final loss to the Astros, Aaron Judge speaks, and I didn't feel it was appropriate to ask him a question for my book and a press gathering that was about the game and about this season. I felt it was inappropriate, and I wasn't going to do it. Everybody was lining up. Thank Aaron, because he's a guy that all season in his entire career gave of himself to fans, his teammates, and the media. You'll look, he still does it today. When you ask him a question, he pauses, thinks about it, then articulates his answer. So he does it. It's not just cookie cutter formulated answers. Yeah. He really thinks about it. Going back to opening day 3 or 4 years ago, I was out there covering it for Channel 2 at the time, and there was nobody in the Yankee clubhouse. Aaron Judge comes out, and I say, hey, Aaron, can I talk to you? I need a couple sound bites for the new news and the 5 and 6. He goes, I'll come to you after I go to the trainer, probably like 12:15. I'm like, well, the sports will be done. We're at the top of the news, and Skip is speaking. Boone was speaking at that time. Is there any chance I could get you now to do two questions? He said, let me go tell my trainer. He goes in, comes out, do the interview. The entire press corps comes around us. And at that point, I'm done with my two questions. No one else asked anything. And he's staring at me. It's like, Todd, anything else? I'm like, no. We walk back into the clubhouse. He's like, what was that, Todd? Like, you could have asked me anything. You had me there. Where am I going? And I said, Aaron, I'm a man of my word. When I say two questions, it's two questions. And who is doing who a favor?
Yes.
You change your schedule to help me. Yes. I'm not taking advantage of it. So now we go to the end of the Astros game where I left you in this story about a half hour ago. Aaron Judge, the entire press corps is lined up to thank him for helping them out. I wasn't a beat writer. I wasn't there every day. I was there, you know, 20 times during the year. So I waited. I was last. I walked up to Aaron and I thanked him. I recanted that story and other stories that he had helped me with. And I said, you're not going to believe this, but yesterday my publisher came to me and we had a big meeting and we decided we were going to add this season to my book. He said, what's the book on? I said, the 20 greatest moments in New York sports history. He goes, and I
available everywhere. Available everywhere.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, your local bookstore, Dave. In Connecticut, it's available, even though there's too many Red Sox fans there. Thank you for pointing that out. So he goes, wow. He goes, that's fantastic. He goes, that's really cool. And I said, look, this is an inappropriate time. Just tell me, but could I ask you one question for the book? He's like, of course. Where am I going? So I said to him, I said, here's my one question. We have tons of quotes about what it meant to you. Talked a lot about that. And my question to you is, how did you handle pressure of the home run chase with such grace and such class?
Yeah, that's true. I agree with that. Yeah.
And how did you handle the media with 1,000 questions every day with such deference and such class and such grace? I said, it's something that really stood out to me. And I want to know, I've never heard you talk about it. I've never heard you asked about it. And to me, I think that my readers would find that interesting. And I think it would be something unique for the book. He talked about, number one, he felt if he approached every day and every at-bat, one at bat at a time. He didn't let the pressure overwhelm him. And he thought that if he went up there and did his best every day to help his team win, that the home runs would come. Mm-hmm. And he said part of being a good leader, and he was named captain this year, was your responsibility to fans. And he signed every autograph to the media and then to lead your teammates. He took all of them very, very seriously. And that was his answer. And I thought that it was incredibly interesting, incredibly insightful. I was proud to be able to share that. And then I went on to ask four more questions because he was leaving New York. No, that was it. Yeah. I asked one question as promised. And I said, thank you, shook his hand. And even though I was the only person there, didn't ask another question because my word is my bond, Tom.
Yes, it is. And it sounds like this.
Well, let me ask a question, God damn it.
All right, David, go ahead. I have to humor him.
I thought this was just me and Tom, David. I thought you were just a pretty face here.
He is.
I am, but
you got the whole Billy Idol thing working.
Yep.
Earrings,
tattoos.
Lady.
Yeah. Well,
David just came back from his handsome lessons. Be nice.
It's a tough job. Somebody's got to do it.
Right.
But what I wanted to, going back to the Reggie Jackson 3 home run.
Sure.
And how important that was. To a certain extent, the fact that the Yankees were really in bad shape this year. How do you feel the 2-3 home run games that Judge has are, I mean, in the pantheon, that Reggie game is just unbelievable. Do we take it for granted, Judge being Judge, that...
No, I don't think we take it for granted, but let's put Reggie's home runs into context for one moment. Okay, the year before they hadn't made the World Series in 15 years, Chambliss hits the walk-off against KC. They make it to the World Series and they lose. This is the following year. They had brought Reggie in to win a World Series. There was all the controversy about he was the straw that stirs the drink and Munson only stirs it poorly. And there was all the battling with Billy Martin. Billy Martin's let go. In the middle of the year, Lemon comes in and says, you guys made it to the World Series last year. Just go out there and play and be you, and you guys will be fine. You guys will win. There was a newspaper strike, as Tom had pointed out. So there wasn't the pressure on the team. Now they get to the World Series, right? They've got a chance to win it all in game six. And the hardest thing to do in sports is hit a round ball with a round bat. Reggie Jackson hits not one, not two, but 3 home runs on 3 pitches against 3 different pitchers to win the World Series for the Yankees, their first World Series, and restore glory. Judge's 3 home run games are very nice in a losing season. I'm very happy for them. They padded some stats and brought a smidge of joy in a hellacious season.
Yes.
It does not stand up to my view of history.
Now I've got another question for you. Most Manhattanites are Yankee fans.
True.
Yes. Nowadays.
Most forever, I think.
Here in the 80s. I was in this very room in the 80s. And I was in Mets town. But go ahead. I'll cede to you.
You have the Giants. Manhattanites are more Giants fans than Jets fans. Do you think a lot of that has to do with the Mets going to the Polo Grounds after Dodgers and everything else?
I'll tell you what I think it has to do with. I think it has to do with Long Island. So what happens with Long Island is all Long Islanders support the Islanders and supported the Jets when they played at Shea and the Mets when they played at Shea. So from Queens off to London, you stop at London, but all the way east, they tend to fall that way. Manhattan and west, they tend to be Yankees, Rangers, and Giant fans. Right. And they, if the you think teams. About it, the Giants play. What happened, Dave?
The good team.
Yes.
What did he say that was funny, Tom?
The good teams. He always lambastes me for being a Mets fan. But no, you're absolutely right. As he should.
Wait, can we just stop this whole podcast for 1 second?
Yes.
Because I'm at home now and I don't hear that at home. Todd, you are absolutely right. Those words have never been spoken in this house being married. And just hearing them, even though they're coming through a speaker, is so hard to tell. So thank you for this moment. Thank you. Thank you. Thank not even my son.
Not even Jagger. But it's true. And yes, and of course, right, it's the whole Long Island thing, which is why I want to commend you for including the Islanders Oilers for Stanley Cups, because the Islanders are never thought of as a New York team.
They are the
It says it on their jerseys, New York.
Oh, it says New York. It says New York. They're New York. You know what? They were a dynasty.
An unparalleled hockey dynasty. Will that ever happen in any sport again, that a team wins four consecutive championships with homegrown players, not like the 94 Rangers, which basically bought the Edmonton Oilers. Sorry for those Ranger fans out there. But the Islanders, probably one of the greatest sports dynasties in the history of New York.
But think of their name, the Islanders. You think they're from the Caribbean.
Well, I mean, I confuse them with the Caribbean team all the time.
Yes.
It's crazy. And how the ice stays solid.
It's amazing.
The of the Caribbean side, I've never understood.
They're playing reggae during those
they
hockey
play
games.
Right, yes. Sly and Robbie, I know.
It's
yeah.
a miracle. And the fact that Pot Van sucks, I mean, you know, it all factors in.
It really does. Hey, listen, Eddie Jockman, that's what I'm saying. Eddie Jockman.
Right?
But Billy Smith was a legend as well. I mean, you can't.
Oh, my God.
Right. Yeah. And Chico Resch, of course, who actually advertised for my parents' business. But
as he should have. It was the right thing for him to do.
What
How
about
do think you afforded that beautiful baseball?
Didn't they do a TV show about
gift,
Chico
actually.
And the Man?
Yes, they did.
Yes. Chico.
Todd, let's go fast forward 30 years and Jagger is a sports writer. Is he going to be able to, are we still going to be able to define 20 great sports moments in the digital era?
Yeah. So another reason that I wrote this book is, and I've explained this to my mom and to people my whole life, music is a close second, and I'll get to that. But you watch a sporting event, the Jets opening game, which I covered for Channel 11, that walk-off punt beat the Bills, and you look at MetLife Stadium, it's up for grabs. And what do you see? You see people hugging the person to their left, person to their right, the person behind them. They don't know these people. They don't care. They're all Jet fans. Sports galvanizes communities. The next day after a big win at the water cooler at work, people are talking about that game. You're on a bus and you see somebody wearing a hat of that team. You just Well, not the Cyclones, because they never really won anything. But you bring up the game last night. It brings communities together. I think that music has a way of bringing people together, the Grateful Dead being the best example of that.
Yeah.
It's the greatest band in the history of the planet Earth, and there's nothing like a Grateful Dead concert, and either you guys agree or I'm hanging up on the Zoom. But sports has a way. The Dead bring those people together on that night. Sports brings an entire community together. So to answer your question, in 30 years, yes, we will be able to identify 20 moments. And they will probably be these 20 moments, which is why this book is evergreen. You can buy it today. You can buy it next year. You can buy 100 of them.
Get it on Kindle, for God's sakes.
Right. Barnes & Noble, don't you know?
Well, don't be shy. You know, we should promote the book. All right, Todd.
The right thing to do.
What's the name of the book again?
The 20 greatest moments in New York sports history. History.
There you go.
History. And what a great playlist we have for you. What David and I, when we were reading the book, I had to go back on YouTube and find the Joe Namath pantyhose commercial. And, you know, it's so tame.
This commercial will prove to the women of America that Beauty Mist pantyhose can make any legs look like $1 million.
Now, I don't wear pantyhose, but if Beauty Mist can make my legs look good, imagine what they'll do for yours.
Somehow, everything looks better through Beauty Mist.
Especially your legs.
I remember people were outraged because, you know, Joe was in pantyhose. And with the Noxzema commercial with Farrah Fawcett, I guess it was.
What do you get when you press on a can of Noxzema?
Great balls of comfort.
You get
great balls of comfort.
You get
great balls of comfort. It's Noxzema.
The closer you shave, the more you need the comfort of Noxzema. Wild for it. Lime, medicated menthol, and regular.
That was a big deal in 1970.
Huge.
Yeah.
All cultural things.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So this is fur coats on the sidelines. Man was Broadway Joe.
Yeah, yeah, and again, that's it brought back all these memories for those of us who were there, and for those of us who weren't there, like your son. Hopefully, you know, this will help him get a grasp on history because it's so important. It's so very, very important. And it's right. It's not just a book about sports. It's a book about culture, and it's a book about relationships and all that stuff. So, and
it's not just a book. It's an institution. Go out and buy it, for God's sakes.
Where can you get it, David?
You can get it anywhere. You can get it Bookends, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Stick it on your Kindle. Stick it anywhere you want. But just stick it.
Just stick it.
20 greatest moments in New York sports history, 1960. That was the year I was born, David, to the present day. All right. Now I'm looking forward to the next Todd book. It'll only take him about 20 years. So we.
That's it.
Yeah.
We'll be on ARP radio at that time. We should be on that now. All right, Todd, thank you for being a guest. We're going to have this out in a couple of weeks, right, David?
No, actually, we're going to do this next week.
Oh, we got to help with some books.
Yeah, then we're going to do the weather report things.
Oh, we're going to do the weather report. That's the band weather report, not the weather.
But here's the thing. You don't know which way. Wait, what did Dylan say? You don't know which way.
To know which way the wind blows.
The wind blows.
Yes.
That's right.
We've been interviewing lots of authors lately, and we just did this guy by the name of, what was it, Craig Bianchi wrote a fabulous
Kurt
book.
Kurt Bianchi,
of course. I'm the Norm Crosby.
Craig. His brother Craig also
wrote a fabulous book on the jazz fusion band Weather Report, and David and I went absolutely gaga over it. But these are the two books we really wanted to discuss. Elegant People and Todd's.
I don't have to read again.
Yeah. But it was really.
Dave.
This is your shining moment.
I'm rereading the sports book.
You know, David's written. David, how many books have you written?
18.
Yes, but they're music theory books. You don't want to read them.
Nevertheless, writing a book is it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
Not easy, David. I respect that. And 18 is high. It's lucky.
That's right. High.
I'm just saying.
All right. Well, David, maybe you could send Todd an autographed copy of your alternative bass tunings. I'm sure he'll spend...
yes, he'll really understand that one.
That's one of my favorites. Yeah. You know, it's a beautiful
one. It's a page turner.
Absolutely. Actually, that's you. You wrote a book on bass players. That's how we met. David was a fan of my website for some reason, and I was a fan of his. which was the bass guitar channel.
It was during COVID. I had nothing to do.
Yeah, and I have COVID now, by the way.
True.
And he had the bass guitar channel. Then we did a radio show called My Generation. And then we did a radio show called The Bass Guitar Channel. And he said, what the hell? Why are we only talking to bass players? And then
they're boring.
They're boring. We got notes from an artist and we still talk to bass players. Although we've got to get one of your Grateful Dead members on there. We've been trying to get Bob Weir. I'd love to speak to Billy Kreutzmann. He wrote a fabulous book.
Billy and the kids.
Yeah, so we hopefully
he's out with the kids.
Yeah,
he's babysitting.
He's that was a great book. So hopefully we'll get to him. So anyway, all right, Toddy.
I'll help you with that.
Get back to work on the next book, and I'll send you all the links and everything else when this goes up.
Please.
All right, it'll be on Cygnus Radio on next Monday, and then the following day the podcast will be out, and we'll be sure to plug the book. All right, good to see you, Todd.
Good.
Be well, sir.
Good meeting you.
Like on.
Nice meeting you. Thank you guys very much for this. It was very nice of you. And thank you for the kind words about the book. It really means a lot.
Well, they're all true.
I appreciate it. It's great. Right.
Peace out.
David, fantastic interview with Todd Ehrlich.
Yeah, and it's great because he kept patting me on the back. I like that and slapping you in the face. It's funny. What a memorable book. And as I was saying in our interview, that game, October 14th, 1969, it brought back such great memories because I remember it was a beautiful fall day. It also made me think about things further back and then things further forward. Or is it further father? Father further. It has something to do with the Marx Brothers. I know that.
I came into this college to get my son out of it. I remember the day he left to come here, a mere boy and a beardless youth. I kissed them both goodbye. By the way, where is my son? Young lady, would you mind getting up so I can see the sunrise?
Wanted to let you all know that the music for today is going to be kind of interesting because it's all based on sports. You kick it, you bat it, you throw it. You catch it, you put it in the hoop, boom, it's everywhere.
All right, so thanks to our listener, and you may be listening to this on Cygnus Radio. We're on Cygnus Radio every Monday evening at 8 p.m. ET. That is www.cygnusradio.com. Or David, they can be listening to this on our podcast, which is available on Apple, Amazon, Buzzsprout, Spotify. What was that sound? And wherever podcasts are podded. So listen to us on the podcast, listen to us live, or just come by our house. And we'll yell out the window and tell you all about our show.
Exactly. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.